T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it, with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thank you for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. 20 years ago, I was a reporter in Spokane, Washington, and covered the Aryan Nations getting kicked out of Hayden Lake, Idaho, after losing their compound in a lawsuit from the Southern Poverty Law Center. As someone who grew up in the northeast of the U.S., the idea of a group like the Aryan Nations even existing was anathema to me. And watching it parade down Coeur d'Alene, Idaho was surrealistic. The Aryan Nation quietly departed Idaho in, at the time, what felt like a last gasp at white supremacism. That was obviously not the case, as we now see a proliferation of groups across the U.S. to take up that banner. And they are taking bold actions, including the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Joining the Crisis Next Door to talk about the current state of white supremacist groups in the U.S. is Jason Blazekas, a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center. Jason is a terrorism expert who devises strategies to prevent terrorists from gaining access to money and publicity. He presently works as professor of practice and director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Jason, thank you for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Great to be with you, Jason. Thank you for the introduction, and I look forward to our chat.
Jason, the Department of Homeland Security recently released its first Homeland Threat Assessment report. And while Russia and China continue to get red flags for cyber and social media threats to U.S. national security, white supremacists and neo-Nazis were judged as the biggest non-state actor threat to the U.S., surpassing ISIS and al-Qaeda. That's a stunning designation. ISIS and al-Qaeda have obvious destructive capabilities. How big of a threat are white supremacists and other far-right militias to America?
It's a significant threat. The Homeland Security Threat Assessment, which was produced in mid-October, really highlighted the scale in which and the intensity in which some of these white supremacists have been carrying out terrorist attacks, particularly during the 2018 through 2019 time period. There's a graph within the Homeland Threat Assessment that really shows the scale of number of individuals killed by white supremacists in that two-year period, nearly 40 individuals, relative to homegrown violent extremists, essentially individuals inspired by ISIS and al-Qaeda, which was fewer than five. So there has been a significant uptick, and it says a lot that this particular administration, the Trump administration, which for some time downplayed the threat from white supremacists, is touting that the threat is so significant. And there's one passage in particular, I think, in that assessment that really underscores the violence that we're seeing. And these acts of violence really do tend to focus on within sort of the white supremacist target set, individuals who may be racially or religious minorities, members of the LGBTQ community. Those who promote multiculturalism and globalization. So the number of kinds of potential targets white supremacists could look at is quite significant. And I think in terms of the threat, I think it became stark when you saw Robert Bowers carry out the terrible attack on the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I think that in many ways that was an inflection point for federal authorities to start looking at the white supremacist threat more seriously. Prior to that, reports like this essentially weren't being produced, particularly by this administration. The last significant DHS report on the threat of white supremacists and the radical right came out in 2009, and it became a political pinata, unfortunately. So in some ways, while the report is disconcerting to see the rise of the white supremacist extremist threat in the United States, it's good to see that there's actually a report being produced by the Department of Homeland Security on the actual threat.
You mentioned the Bowers attack in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What did we make of the kidnapping plot of Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer? Is this a canary in the coal mine, so to speak?
That threat and that targeted kidnapping of Gretchen Whitmer by the so-called militia movement known as the Wolverine Watchmen, that was a really serious plot. And it seems like those individuals were also inspired by the so-called Boogaloo movement as well. And in that plot, you had individuals associated with the Watchmen who were engaged in serious communication and operational security. They actually carried out training. They were individuals who actually went to arrange and changed up the locations in which they were training. They bought special tactical gear. They were carrying out surveillance. So this was a really serious threat. And I think since the initial arrest, there were one or two more arrests, and more information came to light that they were also considering a plot to harm the governor of Virginia as well, all under the onus or the perception of the and being motivated by the idea somehow that their rights were being stomped upon by the decision by the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, to have Michigan put in a lockdown because of COVID-19, and also the perception that so-called leftists were trying to take their guns, right? So they were being animated by this sort of these dual themes that became quite prevalent in the spring of 2020.
Let's break down a couple of these groups that we do know by name. And you mentioned the Boogaloo Boys. Who are the Boogaloo Boys? What do they want? What are they doing? And you know, how many are we talking about? What are their numbers? Do we have any idea?
Great question. So the Boogaloo movement is a movement that's really kind of a patchwork mix of anti-government, pro-gun, some neo-Nazi, white supremacist, and libertarian-motivated individuals that were formed in as a movement in 2019. You know, the name Boogaloo goes back much further than that, you know, about 8 years before that, where you saw within online communities the idea within the white supremacist community that a civil war would occur. And Boogaloo was kind of this catch-all phrase for an impending civil war that would happen. And there would be a race war that would spring up. And the Boogaloo Boys, you know, very much an eclectic mix of ideologies. But the one thing that I say that would kind of binds them all together in the context of this movement is a disdain and hatred for government. And they are becoming more active, and they are leveraging protests that are happening throughout the United States, even those related to social inequities that exist in the wake of the George Floyd protests. You know, while I don't see them as really caring that much about social equality, they see the protests as a mechanism to create mayhem, to create violence. And they really, I think, have done a disservice to the protests that are happening by carrying out acts of violence or planning acts of violence. And there are a couple like really important ones, I think, for listeners to be aware of. One in my backyard here in California, where you had an active member of the Air Force by the name of Stephen Carrillo, who carried out alleged attack against a federal police officer in Oakland, California, during the protests that were happening in Oakland in the wake of the George Floyd killing. And then the second attack that individual carried out in Santa Cruz against a local police officer, a deputy sheriff. And I think the targets that Stephen Carrillo picked and the timing in which he carried out his attacks really illustrate the group, its focus on government and police. And whether it's a libertarian Boogaloo, whether it's an anti-government Boogaloo individual, a pro-gun Boogaloo individual, it is that shared disdain for that government, for the U.S. government, that really unites them. And these are individuals, too, that are extremely well-armed. In the case of Stephen Carrillo, obviously well-trained. And the second example I want to give your listeners some time to think about is an attack that was foiled, thankfully, by federal authorities in Las Vegas, where you had three individuals who were part of the Boogaloo movement who were planning to carry out a Molotov cocktail attack on protesters in related to the George Floyd death again. And those individuals were trying to use the protest as a camouflage to carry out civil unrest. So in the context of the organization, the Boogaloo movement, they are, I think, perhaps the most profound threat in terms of what we're seeing within the radical right in the United States, because you have individuals who are willing to actually be proactive and not reactive in the context of trying to start a civil conflict, whereas you have perhaps other larger militia movements like the Oath Keepers and Three Percenters that I see as being more kind of reactionary, reacting to events, as opposed to the Boogaloo movement, who is trying to spark unrest, if that makes sense.
Jason, what do you think has given rise to their desire to be more proactive? That I think that's one of the things that really grabs the attention. We've known that white supremacists have existed for a long time. The KKK, they've been around. But to see such proactive movements taking place right now, what do you think has driven them to this point where they could feel confident in doing so?
I think there are a few things at play. One is this perception of government overreach and the perception that state governments are going to take the guns of individuals. So one theme within the Boogaloo movement is this infatuation with arms and a deep concern that their Second Amendment rights may be eroded. And one of the first times they made their perhaps public debut, kind of moving from the online world to the offline world, was in Richmond, Virginia, in January of 2020, when there were these pretty significant Second Amendment protests that were happening at the state capitol. And that's where you saw individuals dressed in Hawaiian shirts with heavy arms and assault weapons protesting the potential decision by the Virginia House of Burgess to put into place more gun measures to check the expansion of guns. And I think that is one of the primary motivating factors with individuals in this movement. And it certainly doesn't help that there's been some rhetoric at the very highest levels of government saying that there are initiatives to take away those guns. You know, you may recall, for instance, President Trump mentioning in April of 2020 that the Second Amendment rights were going to be completely eroded unless people voted for Republicans, highlighting the need to liberate Virginia, Minnesota, and Michigan. So, you know, in 2020, you have that theme as well. The second big issue that's animating individuals associated with the Boogaloo Boys in this Wolverine Watchman militia that was engaged in the kidnapping plot of the Michigan governor is this lockdown associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. And there's certainly a perception within the Boogaloo movement that lockdown is an example of government overreach. The perception being their ability to make ends meet is being crippled by decisions put forward by bureaucrats. And that's one thing that the Boogaloo movement has a disdain for, individuals who they see as bureaucrats who are eroding their ability to carry guns and to, you know, essentially have a livelihood that is being perhaps damaged because of the pandemic and some of the decisions that have come in the wake of it related to the lockdown.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking with Jason Blazekas, a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center. Jason is a terrorism expert who devises strategies to prevent terrorists from gaining access to money and publicity. And we're talking about the rise of white supremacists in the U.S. Another group besides the Boogaloo Boys that have been in the spotlight to some degree have been the Proud Boys. What do we know about the Proud Boys? Are they in the same level as the Boogaloo Boys?
So I look at the Boogaloo movement as being different from the Proud Boys in a few ways. The Proud Boys are more organized. They have a centralized online presence. They are individuals with a known leader. They are individuals who are different from the Boogaloo Boys in the sense that I look at them as being more reactionary, whereas the Boogaloo Boys are more proactive. That doesn't mean that the Proud Boys are you know a non-threat. They are a threat in the sense that they do go to left-leaning cities where protests are occurring, where they perceive to be left-wing so-called Antifa individuals and Black Lives Matter protesters who are enmeshed in protests for social equality, for you know, highlighting the fact that there are situations in this country where police have used force that has not been proportionate against Black individuals. And in a way, their Proud Boys are going to these places to intentionally try to provoke conflict. So I see them kind of like a street gang. Now, they describe themselves as kind of a pro-Western fraternal organization for men. But I look at them more along the lines of a neo-fascist group that hates Islam, that's against immigration, that's against globalization, and they are highly misogynistic. And they most certainly have individuals within the rank and file who adhere to white supremacist ideals, even though the organization disavows white supremacy. I think, again, there are individuals within the Proud Boys who are absolutely white supremacists. So they've been around since 2016. They were founded by a guy named Gavin McGinnis, who was the co-founder of Vice Media. And in terms of analogs, I like to compare them to a group that operated in England that was founded by a guy named Tommy Robinson in 2012, known as the English Defense League, which was essentially a kind of protest movement, a single issue group that was essentially designed to spark conflict with the Muslim community throughout London. So they would, you know, intentionally protest, you know, Islam. They would protest what they thought was the overreach of Sharia in England. And in some ways, I see the Proud Boys doing the same things, going out as kind of a protest movement against the left. So to me, they're more reactionary. They certainly have been emboldened as well, as listeners probably are aware of. President Trump specifically told them to stand by and stand down. And the organization, when they heard those words during the, I think it was the second presidential debate, really got excited and developed memes and imagery, essentially hearkening to that language of President Trump. So they made shirts. They developed mottos. I think some online researchers have found perhaps even recruitment's gone up. And they stand ready, particularly during this really difficult time period in America, to go out and provide, quote, protection, perhaps even to polling locations, which, you know, what they term protection, I would say, I would term intimidation. And that's one thing I worry about the Proud Boys being perhaps near polling places and trying to intimidate individuals who may want to essentially exert their ability and right to vote.
How do you think Joe Biden will treat white supremacist groups if he wins the White House? And how do you think those groups are going to react if Biden beats Trump?
So that's a really good question. In terms of a Biden administration, I see a number of things that would likely happen very differently in terms of how the U.S. government uses the tools it possesses to counter the threat emerging from the radical right, to include militia movements and white supremacists. The first thing I think, something that needs to be done is in a reexamination of the current laws. In the United States does not have a domestic terrorism law. And Congress has a number of very good bills that have been introduced to introduce a new law that would criminalize forms of violence that clearly meet the litmus test of terrorism that right now individuals aren't being charged for. And in some cases, in Michigan, for instance, I think you had six individuals who were charged with state-related terrorism charges, because I think in the end, after a coordination between the federal government and state authorities, it was probably determined that the best pathway for those individuals was the prosecution of them through state law, not federal law. And I think that really signals an issue with federal law as it relates to the issue of domestic terrorism. So I think that's one thing we will see with a Biden administration is a reexamination of the current laws and perhaps an effort to put in place a domestic terrorism law so we can criminalize acts carried out by individuals like Robert Bowers so they can be characterized appropriately as acts of terrorism. Bowers, the individual who carried out the Tree of Life synagogue shooting, was in charge for an act of terrorism. And that really, I think, starkly illustrates the deficiency in U.S. law. And the Trump administration has been unwilling to pass a domestic terrorism law. So that's the first thing I see the Biden administration doing. Second thing I see them doing is acknowledging that there is a transnational aspect to the white supremacist movement. In that sense, the U.S. government has a number of tools available to it to, for instance, sanction white supremacist transnational groups that are based overseas. And that tool has only been used in one instance. On April of 2020, the Trump administration designated a group known as the Russian Imperial Movement, a ultra-nationalist group based in Russia, as the name implies, that has white supremacist leanings. Only one designation using those tools that the State Department and Treasury Department possess. And I think you would see an expansion of the use of those tools by the Biden administration to sanction other white supremacist groups that are based overseas. Why does that matter from a domestic perspective? A lot of these transnational groups have linkages, these overseas-based groups, to U.S.-based groups. So I think it would provide more leverage for law enforcement to go after even domestic-based groups who may have those connectivities with transnational, foreign-based white supremacist organizations. And then thirdly, I think you'll see perhaps a reallocation of resources to a greater extent than the Trump administration has done in terms of studying and trying to neutralize and counter the threat. In that sense, I could see perhaps the FBI sending in more agents, for instance, to essentially investigate white supremacist groups. I think you would have Department of Homeland Security probably allocate more resources to trying to understand the domestic threat posed by white supremacist groups in the context of the Biden administration. In the Trump administration, one of the primary offices responsible within DHS to actually examine the threat was disbanded. So I think you would see that message as well in terms of human resources being reallocated in ways to, I think, challenge the rising threat of white supremacy in the ways that the Trump administration has not done. Okay, the second question, Jason, that you asked, what will this radical right in America do should the Biden administration, should there be a Biden administration and Joseph Biden wins the election? I think there are a range of possibilities here. I tend to think that there is a lot of rhetoric about a so-called civil war happening if Joe Biden wins the election. I actually don't think there will be a civil war. I see what's more likely to occur perhaps being low scale acts of violence, shootings, you know, things of that nature at a lower level, not a full blown civil war as perhaps those on the radical right hope to see. I don't think that's going to occur. I don't think necessarily we're going to see a significant amount of violence actually on election day where polling stations are attacked. I think that's probably less likely than more likely. I think during the post-election period after November 3rd, you may have individuals, if it looks like Joe Biden's going to win, who may be more likely to carry out acts of violence at a lower form and level. And here I'm talking about individuals maybe acting in onesies and twosies, carrying out kinds of actions like we saw Stephen Carrillo carry out in places like Oakland, California, where the federal police officer was killed, or the killing of the Santa Cruz deputy sheriff. I think that's the more likely outcome in terms of the kinds of activities we could see. The only outlier to that, the only caveat I have is, President Trump's rhetoric. Now, if President Trump goes on the record and tries to inspire individuals to challenge the election and to stand by, if you will, to do something, that is the great outlier to me. And I hope the President Trump, if he were to lose, would be responsible and use appropriate rhetoric that doesn't ratchet up tensions that could inspire individuals to carry out act of violence.
Jason, I wanted to ask you one final question. Is there anything the U.S. can learn and adopt from Germany as it's dealt with neo-Nazis since World War II?
In terms of so right now Germany has very strict laws about paraphernalia associated with neo-Nazis, having that paraphernalia, exhibiting it, having it seen publicly and showing it publicly is outlawed. And I think given the free speech rules that we have, the First Amendment that we have here in the United States, that trying to ban that kind of imagery outright is a bridge too far. That's not to say that the Germans don't provide us some good examples on how to counter the threat. They have a pretty significant and robust set of law enforcement and intelligence officials who are studying the neo-Nazi threat that have certainly led to a significant number of arrests of individuals associated with the neo-Nazi movement in Germany. And I think that would be one way, for instance, the U.S. could learn. And if as I mentioned before, if the Biden administration wins, I do see them exerting sort of their influence to put more individuals in place who can actually study the threat along the lines perhaps of the way the Germans have done. Now, the last thing I would say on Germany is that there are also other challenges related to sort of the German situation as it relates to the challenge of white supremacy and neo-Nazis. And there have been a number of really good reports and investigative journalists who have highlighted the fact that the German law enforcement and intelligence community, even the military establishment, may be significantly penetrated by individuals who have white supremacist leanings. And in that sense, I think there is this shared concern that the United States and Germany may have regarding sort of penetration by individuals who may be linked to the white supremacist community. So I think Germany needs to still do a better job of rooting out those individuals who have essentially infiltrated their national security system to ensure that they can't do harm from within. And I think that's an ongoing challenge in Germany. And I think the U.S. can observe sort of how Germany is trying to counter those challenges, because in many of the cases we just talked about today, we have seen either active or former military members, and there are militia movements like the Oath Keepers who have former military, former law enforcement, and even in some cases active law enforcement at the local level, and active military who are on their roles within these militia movements. So the United States, I think, has to do a better job of understanding the threat posed from within. And in some cases, I guess here, Germany could provide us an example, but also a warning too.
The rise in white supremacism has been a worrisome and troublesome trend, and we could certainly look forward to more fluid developments in the days, months, and years ahead. Jason, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
My pleasure, Jason. Take care.
We've been joined by Jason Blazekas, a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center. He presently works as professor of practice and director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.